wanted a campaign that featured me covered in feces from every species, a recurring theme in season one. A stickler for realism, Barsky also proposed a campaign that featured intimate portraits of me with each of the barnyard animals I had inseminated, artificially, in my ongoing attempts to demystify the secrets of animal husbandry. All these ideas had one thing in common. They were non-starters. As a result, we were stuck. Happily, my lawyer was on the case. I don't have an agent, or a manager, or a publicist. I have a Mary. Around the office, we call her the Irish Hammer. Mary Sullivan is her full name. She's a former bio major who woke up one day and decided to practice law instead. I'm glad she did. Mary has Farrah Fawcett's hair and Albert Einstein's brain, and once I realized the latter was bigger than the former, I started asking her opinion on everything. Mary had caught wind of the Working Class Hero campaign already. She'd snorted, elegantly, and called my boss. Mike isn't a hero, she'd explained. He's not the star of the show. He's not even a host. His job is not to be in the spotlight. His job is to shine the spotlight. My job is to keep him from becoming an asshole. Or worse, from looking like one. Candor is a rare commodity in Hollywood. So too is charm. The Irish Hammer has both in spades. And so, the network had backed off. But now, we were back to square one with the promo. And time was running out. What do you think I should do? I asked Mary. We need to film something this week. Without looking up from her desk, the Irish Hammer said, What about the pig? What pig? The pig in the open of the show. Every episode of Dirty Jobs opens with a shot of me carrying a 200-pound swine from a barn to a pig pen. Incidentally, that pig appeared to have an erection, which nobody noticed until viewers started to write in with questions, but that's a story for another day. I'm not sure I understand, I told Mary. You want to make a pig the star of the show? More like the mascot, she said. A metaphor for hard work. But pigs don't work hard, I said, unless truffle hunting counts. The Irish Hammer looked at me in the way that a smart person might regard an idiot. Do you know what a metaphor is? I think so. Have you ever cleaned a pig pen? Several, I said. Was it difficult? Yes. Was it pleasant? No. All right, then. If you want to honor people who do difficult, unpleasant jobs without coming off as earnest or making it all about you, elevate the pig. Viewers aren't stupid. They'll figure it out. And you won't end up looking like an asshole. See what I mean? Don't let the Farrah Fawcett hair fool you. The next day, we booked a 300-pound sow for a most unusual photo shoot. She was chauffeured to Hollywood from a farm in Central Valley and arrived in style at the soundstage bright and early, ready for her close-up. She was a perfect pig, straight from the animal equivalent of Central Casting, pink with gray spots and a sweet disposition, like Wilbur from Charlotte's Web, but all grown up. I called her Rhonda. In a pristine studio with white walls and a white floor, I watched as Rhonda was coaxed up a ramp that led to the top of a white pedestal 4 feet off the ground. Once she was situated, the ramp was removed, and I took my place beside her. It was a simple setup. Standing next to Rhonda, I would look into the camera and riff about the unsung heroes of Dirty Jobs. I'd conclude with a pointed question. So, what's on your pedestal? It was a play on that credit card commercial. What's in your wallet? I nailed it on the first take, in front of a room full of nervous executives. Unfortunately, Rhonda nailed it too. Just as I asked, what's on your pedestal, she crapped all over hers. It was an enormous dump, delivered with impeccable timing. During the second take, Rhonda did it again, right on cue, this time with a frightful spray of diarrhea that filled the studio with a sulfurous funk, blackening the white walls of our pristine set and transforming my blue jeans into something browner. I could only marvel at the stench, while the horrified executives backed into a corner, a huddled mass, if you will, yearning to breathe free. But Rhonda wasn't done. She crapped on every subsequent take. and when she could crap no more, she began to pee. She peed on my cameraman. She peed on her handler. She peed on me. Finally, when her bladder was empty, we got a take that the network could use, along with a commercial that won several awards for excellence in promos. Yeah, they have trophies for such things. Interestingly, the footage that went viral was not the footage that aired, but the footage Mary encouraged me to release on YouTube after the fact. The outtakes of Rhonda at her incontinent finest. Those were hysterical and viewed more times than the actual commercial. Go figure. Looking back, putting a pig on a pedestal was maybe the smartest thing I ever did. Not only did it make Rhonda famous, it established me as the non-traditional host of a non-traditional show, one whose primary job was to appear more like a guest and less like a host, and whenever possible, not at all like an asshole. Opinions vary as to the degree to which I accomplished that, but I must have done something right, because Mary Sullivan eventually agreed to leave her firm and partner with me, for which I'm eternally grateful. As for Rhonda, a poster of her now hangs in the office of the Irish Hammer. Like Libby, who welcomes the tired and the poor to these United States, Rhonda welcomes visitors to Microworks, staring out from her pedestal, keeping me honest and just a little bit dirty. Chapter 10, The Orphan Hero. She was an orphan, living on the cold streets of a hard town, doing what she had to do to get by. Unlike most runaways, she didn't bolt when they approached her. In fact, she greeted them with a curious smile and saw their government vehicle for what it was, a warm place on a cold evening. She got in. Now, it's hardly a secret, orphans make great protagonists, Huck Finn and Harry Potter, Pip and Pollyanna, Dorothy Gale and Daenerys Targaryen. Those characters stick with us, but their adventures are entirely fictional, while our protagonist is the real deal. 20 minutes after they found her, she was enjoying a hearty meal and a warm bath, both of which she needed. Then, for the first time in memory, she slumbered uninterrupted. When she awakened, she was escorted to a classroom, where she joined a handful of other recruits in various stages of the program. Our protagonist was a natural. Her instructors described her as focused and a quick study. But it wasn't her aptitude that caught their attention. It was her demeanor. In every challenge, she remained unflappable, seemingly immune to the stress and fatigue that the program was designed to induce. Her instructors were impressed. On Halloween, just 1 week after they found her alone and freezing on the mean streets of the city, the decision was made. They woke her up before dawn and led her to a small room. It was poorly insulated and impossibly cramped. She was seated on a drab leather cushion and commanded to remain as still as possible. Wires dangling from machines were attached to her skin. Food and water were left within easy reach. Our protagonist remained calm. She asked no questions and offered nothing but that same curious smile before the men locked the door behind them. Outside, the instructors gathered around a monitor and watched. Most recruits lasted 15 or 20 minutes before the claustrophobia became too much to bear. She was different. Unfazed, she lay there for an hour, then another after that, gazing calmly at the gray metal roof a foot above her head, smiling, that same curious smile. A day passed, then another. Finally, after 3 days, locked inside the cold and gloomy enclosure, the wait was over. Buttons were pressed, switches were flipped. The rumble of unfamiliar noises filled the air. Objects around her began to behave strangely, as the general theory of relativity became something more than a theory. The sound around her intensified. So did her speed. Within moments, she was hurtling through the troposphere, the stratosphere, the mesosphere, the thermosphere, entering space at 18,000 miles per hour. She was an orphan, 4,000 miles above the streets she used to wander, the first of her kind to orbit the Earth. Those of you who remember the very first days of the space race might recall the way the world held its breath, praying for her safe return. Our protagonist circled the Earth 4 times in zero gravity as the scientist far below monitored her vitals, duly recording every precious scrap of data until there was nothing left to record. Sputnik 2 would carry her corpse another 2,566 orbits before plummeting to Earth, leaving no remains for a proper funeral. Her name was Laika, and though she was most certainly female, she was not a woman. She was a trusting terrier, with a curious smile, a patient disposition, and ears that bent in several directions at once. You see, the Soviets recruited their very first cosmonaut from the frigid streets of Moscow, because they needed a hardy specimen, a cadet who could endure the cold of a poorly insulated capsule. In other words, they needed a dog with the right stuff. Today, Laika's sacrifice is well known in Moscow. In fact, if you visit the icy capital of the former Soviet Union, you'll see her there, back on the streets she used to wander. Memorialized in bronze, she stands upon a rocket and looks toward the heavens, an eternal reminder to those on 2 legs that one small step for man was made possible by one giant leap by man's best friend. Full disclosure, that last story almost broke me. It was the first one I wrote for The Way I Heard It, and it generated more sad-faced emojis and disappointed emails than any of the others. It also inspired an angry voicemail from my mother. Michael, what the hell is wrong with you? No one wants to hear a story about a puppy who dies in outer space. Now I'm depressed, damn it, and using bad language. Call me back. Interesting. I've written lots of stories about man's inhumanity to man, but that was the one story that upset my mother. My girlfriend, Sandy, didn't take it well either. At the end of Laika's sad tale, she threw her headphones across the room. The Russians build her a statue, she said. Who cares? Those godless bastards sent her into space for 7 days with just one meal? What a bunch of cold-blooded scumbags. Sandy struggles sometimes to say how she really feels, like when Michael Vick was convicted of running a dogfighting ring. That guy should be fed to the tigers, she said. The Detroit Tigers, I asked. No, just regular tigers. The NFL could sell tickets. They'd make a killing. I don't have much sympathy for Michael Vick either, but it is striking. People seem to feel more strongly about his dogs than they did about the homeless people they had to step over on the way to their local sports bar. Were those people simply overwhelmed by the sheer volume of human suffering in the world? It's easy these days to turn on CNN, pick up the paper, or scroll through your news feed and conclude that the world's gone to hell. Maybe it has, but is it really worse than it's ever been? I don't think so. We're exposed to more bad news than ever before, and I think maybe we lack the bandwidth to process so much misery. As Joseph Stalin said, and he would have known, the death of one man is a tragedy. The death of 1 million is a statistic. Is that why the story of one little dog who died alone with her little heart racing way out in space cut so deeply? The truth is, I didn't sit down to write about Laika just because I disapproved of the way she was treated, nor did I write about her to provoke my mother into a fit of profanity. That was just a bonus. I wrote about Laika because, once upon a time, she brought the whole world together. And if I'm being entirely honest, I wrote about her because she reminded me of another 15-pound terrier mix, specifically the one chewing on my slippers right now, the one Sandy plucked from a pound in Marin and brought to our apartment in San Francisco. When he came to me, nameless and friendless and tiny and cold, I did what I often do in moments of great uncertainty. I went to my Facebook page and asked people who like me to name him. Those are the same people who have been programming every show I've worked on since 30 Jobs. The same people who have suggested many of the subjects I've written about in this book. I like them too, and I've come to believe that their collective opinion is perilous to ignore. So, I posted a few photos of my new dependent and watched in wonder as 87,000 people wrote in with their suggestions. It was an amazing thing to behold. My little mutt had the whole internet by the tail. After much consideration and some decidedly non-scientific methodologies, I selected the six most popular names. I unfolded a pee pad with six squares on it and wrote one name on each square. Then I set up a camera and waited for my puppy to poop, assuring my Facebook followers that I'd name him according to whatever name he pooped upon. Coincidentally, or maybe not, the puppy pooped on Freddie, the name of my beloved high school teacher and mentor. What were the odds? 1 in 6, I suppose. Looking back, though, it feels inevitable. Point is, in 1957, an orphan from the mean streets of Moscow went to space, and the whole world watched, holding its breath, praying for her safe return. 60 years later, an orphan from the mean streets of Marin took a dump, and 87,000 people watched with bated breath to see where that dump would land. Yet only one is remembered today as a hero. "Give me a break," Sandy's saying. "Laika's no hero. She didn't decide to be shot into space any more than Freddy decided to be videotaped crapping. That statue was built by assholes with a guilty conscience. Period. End of story." She's right. Turning Laika into a hero was a fine way for the Russians to control the narrative. I suppose I control Freddy's narrative, which is why there is no statue in his future. I don't think he'd want one anyway. He seems happy enough with his bone, my slippers, and his own ghost-written blog. There's even talk of a book deal. God help us. But if there were a statue, I know precisely what it would look like. Freddy in bronze, the pee pad in bronze, and a pile of bronze poop partially covering his name. Now that's a statue I could get behind. Chapter 11. Something is Missing. A young officer in a pivotal battle, exasperated by the indecision of his general, takes matters into his own hands. Leaping astride his trusty steed, he gallops to the front of the line to rally his troops. From the back of his horse, he laughs at the enemy, ignores the bullets that fly past his head, and addresses his men like Henry V at Agincourt. According to the many first-hand accounts, it was a moment worthy of a monument. "He was suddenly in the front of the line," said one soldier, "his eyes flashing, pointing with his saber to the advancing foe with a voice that rang clear as a trumpet." "He came from nowhere," another said, "and electrified the men. He simply willed us to follow him. And so we did." In a totally audacious maneuver, the young officer led 3,000 men straight into the flank of a superior foe, scattering the enemy and allowing his general to march his remaining force straight across the battlefield and win the day. But alas, something was missing, namely the general's remaining force. Incredibly, the general had been worried about the wrong thing. Who would end up getting credit for this victory? And so he'd withdrawn his remaining men, settling for a draw. In the official battle report, the general acknowledged the gallantry of those 3,000 soldiers, but again, something was missing. The name of the brave young officer who had led the charge. 3 weeks later, when both sides clashed on the same bloody fields, it was deja vu all over again. At the pivotal moment, the general hesitated, and once again, the ambitious young officer leaped upon his trusty steed and rode to the front lines, this time in direct defiance of his furious commander. When he reached the front line, he reared back on his horse. Once more, he shouted to the troops, "Hello, old friends! So good to see you again! What say you? Shall we win the day, once and for all? Shall we send these bastards back across the sea?" In the movie version, this is where the slow motion begins. The cacophony of battle drops away, replaced by soaring strings. Musket balls and grape shot whir past our hero's head as a junior officer falls in a bloody heap beside him. The strings fade as we hear his pumping heart and labored breath. Close up on his left leg, the same leg that's been twice wounded in earlier battles. A musket ball has lodged deep in his thigh. His temples pound as white-hot pain cascades through his body. Still, our hero rides on. Another musket crack, and all is silent as a gaping wound in the horse's neck spews a crimson river. The great beast howls, rears back, and collapses on our hero, shattering his wounded left leg. Fade to black. There are rare moments that turn the tide of every battle. Rare battles that turn the tide of every war. Rare wars that turn the tide of human history. That was one of those moments, in one of those battles, in one of those wars. As in the Battle of Hastings in 1066, when William, Duke of Normandy, conquered England. As in the Battle of Orléans in 1429, when Joan of Arc saved France. As in D-Day in 1944, when Dwight D. Eisenhower directed the Allied advance into Normandy. The heroes of those battles were recognized for their valor. One became a king, one a saint, one a president. All were honored with statues that stand to this day. So too was the young officer with the shattered leg who lay beneath his horse 240 years ago. Indeed, on that very spot, on this very day, you can still see the monument to our hero erected 100 years after his glorious charge, carved in granite, to last through the ages. The inscription on the back spells out the magnitude of his contribution. In memory of the most brilliant soldier of the Continental Army, who was desperately wounded on this spot, winning for his countrymen the decisive battle of the American Revolution. That's high praise, but it is curious. If you visit this monument for yourself, you might notice that something is missing. For starters, the hero's gaze. His eyes are not overlooking the Hudson Valley in triumph as you might expect them to be, because his statue has no head. His left hand does not hold the reins of his trusty steed, and his right hand does not point a gleaming saber towards the enemy, because his statue has no arms. Closer inspection reveals that something else is missing. Shoulders, along with hips, and a torso. The legs are conspicuously absent. Even the trusty steed, to which the aforementioned reins might be attached, is nowhere to be found. Indeed, there is nothing to this monument but a left boot, draped unceremoniously over the muzzle of a cannon. And then you understand why. The young officer, memorialized in such a strange fashion, forgot to do something on that fateful day. He forgot to die. Pity. Had he simply bled to death in the mud underneath his horse, he'd have cities and schools named in his honor today, along with a proper statue that included his horse, his saber, and the rest of his body. But alas, our hero not only survived the battle, he refused to let the surgeons amputate his ruined limb. His ego would not permit it. He spent the rest of his life in constant pain, hobbling around on a left leg 3 inches shorter than the right, while completely neglecting the less obvious injury that would fester in ways that no doctor could treat. The wound to his pride, which went on to destroy the only thing he valued more than his life. You may not remember Horatio Gates, the indecisive American general who squandered multiple opportunities to defeat the British. but I bet you remember the name of his young officer, the soldier whose bold action won the decisive battle that convinced the French to join America's fight for independence, a decision that, according to the French, anyway, turned 13 unruly colonies into the United States of America. Who knows? Had General Gates simply acknowledged the uncommon valor of his young officer rather than hoarding all the credit for himself, our hero might have made some different choices after his injuries at Saratoga. Maybe then he'd have gotten a proper monument. Instead, he got the boot, the only statue ever dedicated to a specific war hero where something remarkable is missing. The hero's name. In this case, the name of a young officer whose courage helped free a nation, but whose pride turned his once good name into the very definition of betrayal. Benedict Arnold. In 2002, an artist in Oakland offered to cast me in bronze, free of charge. Though it was tempting to think otherwise, his generous offer had nothing to do with me and everything to do with free publicity. It was the kind of quid pro quo to which I'd become accustomed as the host of a long-running, inexplicably popular TV show in San Francisco. According to TV Guide, Evening Magazine provided a half hour of human interest stories and local color. For the most part, this was true. Evening Magazine was packed with segments about local artists, Napa Valley getaways, hidden Bay Area gems, quirky collectors, ingenious inventors, and the kind of people who see the Virgin Mary in their French toast. If there was a three-legged dog in Marin struggling to overcome canine kidney failure or a grape-stomping contest at the state fair, you could count on Evening to bring you the story. As one of the hosts, my job was to introduce these squishy little segments from a different location each night, usually a five-star spa, a museum opening, or the latest Michelin-rated restaurant in Nob Hill. Not exactly meaningful work, but I was good at it, and happy to assume the many perks that came with being a local celebrity. For instance, the artist who reached out to me knew that the promotional value of appearing on a segment was much greater than the $15,000 he typically charged to cast a B-list celebrity in bronze. He also knew that a B-list celebrity would find the prospect of preserving his enormous head for posterity too tempting to ignore. Like Alan Hale Jr., I had not won an Emmy, an unforgivable oversight in a world where everyone is entitled to their own trophy. Perhaps a bronze bust of my chiseled visage could fill the void. My cameraman and I drove to the artist's studio in Oakland. There, I sat for dozens of photos, each taken from a slightly different angle, until every square centimeter of my giant cranium had been captured. Based on those photos, and with the help of some mysterious software program, we made the initial mold, as well as the negative. Several weeks later, we returned and filmed me pouring bronze into the negative. Then we returned once again and revealed the finished product. It was a win for everybody. Viewers got an entertaining look at an intriguing process. The artist was flooded with requests from other narcissists, all of them happy to pay $15,000 for a permanent reminder of their favorite subject. And I got my long overdue trophy, a three-dimensional 200-pound selfie. My delight was short-lived, however. Where exactly does one display a 200-pound version of one's own head? In the entryway? On the piano? Atop the mantel? Sandy and I lived in a modest apartment, one too small, it seemed, for this oversized doppelganger. "It's too heavy for the mantel," she said, "and we don't have a piano or an entryway. Plus, I don't like the way it looks at me." Sensing my disappointment, she added, "Maybe I'll feel differently after you're dead." She had a point. Statues and busts weren't meant to be seen by the subjects they honor, just as photographs weren't meant to be taken by the people who are in them. But what's the appropriate waiting period after my demise? A month? A decade? These days, statues are being pulled down right and left. Perhaps if we'd waited a bit before building monuments to people we think we admire, we wouldn't be tearing those same monuments down today. Think about it. It took us 100 years to give Benedict Arnold his monument. That gave multiple generations plenty of time to consider the depth of his treachery, as well as his valor on that particular field. As a result, he got the memorial he deserved, one that has yet to be toppled. But if Sandy's right, and animal lovers realize the Russians built their statue to Laika not to honor her, but to cover their own conniving asses, should they reconsider that statue? What about Lady Liberty, who seems a bit wobbly up there these days, on that magnificent pedestal of hers? Thinking about it is not going to stop me from filling my Facebook page with selfies. Those little monuments are impossible to topple. But I assure you, today, Bronze Mike sits right where he belongs, under a tarp in my garage, next to some firewood and a bike with 2 flat tires. He's been there for years, out of sight, out of mind, dreaming of the day that he might emerge from the shadows to share the limelight with another monument, one that I'm in no great hurry to accept, the only monument everyone gets, the granite monument, inscribed with the words we hope will sum us up, even as they let us down. Chapter 12. Words, words, words. George understood the consequences of words better than most. So did his son. But now, staring dumbly at the blank tombstone that would mark his boy's final resting place, George was at a loss to find the right ones. What words could possibly sum up the life of the poet that millions of people all over the world were now mourning? Loving son? That wouldn't work. Beloved husband and father? Hardly. In the end, George went with Cathé ton diamina el tu, true to his own spirit. George was satisfied with those words. He hoped James would have approved. But, truth be told, approval was not something George had ever received from James. Nor, in fairness, was it something George had ever offered his rebellious son. Indeed, father and son hadn't spoken since the fateful day James had told the old man he was joining a band. A band? What kind of band? A rock and roll band. I'm going to be the singer. That's ridiculous, George had scoffed. Rock and roll isn't music. Besides, you can't even sing. Now, looking down upon the granite bust of the young man with the long hair and the unearthly gaze, he contemplated the magnitude of his mistaken assessment. George thought about the thousands of protesters who'd been galvanized by his son's words and music. He also thought about some other words, words that he'd spoken in haste 6 years earlier. Back then, George had been patrolling a tense and dangerous coastline in a place most Americans had never even heard of. The seas were high that evening, the fog was thick, and the radar screen showed enemy ships approaching from several directions, approaching quickly. They didn't respond to any warning or communication, so George did what he had to do, speaking the words that would change history. He said, "Open fire." Those words went down to the gunners, men who, unlike George's son, were not inclined to ignore his orders. For nearly 4 hours, George's Navy fired upon enemy ships that refused to leave his radar screen. Meanwhile, thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C., President Johnson got word of the sea battle. He interrupted all three of the networks with some words of his own. "This new act of aggression on the high seas must be met with a positive reply." On national television, the president asked for and received congressional approval to retaliate, and the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was passed. Back in the Gulf, though, after the fog of war had finally lifted, George saw why the enemy ships had been unsinkable. They weren't actually there. The radar hits were not ships at all. They were anomalies brought about by bad weather and high seas, or maybe a technical glitch, whatever the cause, George had been firing into a ghost fleet. George reported the error to his commanders in Hawaii. They called McNamara immediately, but the Secretary of Defense, for whatever reason, didn't relay the message to the president. The airstrikes went off as scheduled, and just like that, we were at war with Vietnam. Oh yes, George understood the consequences of words. Spoken in anger, they had divided his family. Spoken in error, they had divided his country. People still argue about whether his words were an honest mistake or part of a government conspiracy to push Congress into declaring a premature and completely avoidable war. Perhaps the answer to that is best addressed by the words of his son, who once wrote, "There are things known and things unknown, and in between are the doors." Fitting words from a rebellious boy who remained true to his own spirit. The son who could sing after all, and proved it by providing a soundtrack to the war his father had started. A dead poet named Jim Morrison. It was a Saturday morning. I was 14, and there was my father, standing at the foot of my bed, sharpening a double-sided axe. "It's time," he said. "Let's go." My father has a tendency to start conversations in the middle of sentences. He's also suspicious of anything modern, like nouns. "Time for what?" I knew the question was futile before I'd asked it. So, as I rolled out of bed and pulled on my jeans and my work boots, I tried another one. "Is it cold out?" "Invigorating," he said. "Your mother made oatmeal. Eat fast." Our Massey Ferguson tractor idled outside as we loaded up our wooden cart. Ropes and pulleys, jacks and wedges, two chainsaws, and various other weapons of war. Mom added a lunchbox filled with ham sandwiches and green apples to our arsenal, along with a large thermos of coffee. It was snowing already. "Try not to kill yourself," she said. "Dinner's at 6. I can't count the number of times that my dad and I drove the old tractor down that stone road. We'd go through the lower pasture and deep into the woods to do battle with the pine, the maple, the oak, and his favorite, the mighty locust. "The hard wood puts up a tough fight, but it burns the best," he would say. The fact that we heated most of the old farmhouse with nothing but a wood stove was a source of great pride for my father and endless inspiration for witticisms like, "Chop your own wood, it'll warm you twice." The man took great pleasure in finding just the right tree. What he loved even more was chopping that tree down. Although there was nothing nearby but the ground for the tree to fall on, he liked to pretend that there was. He imagined himself as the contestant on some sort of lumberjack game show, challenged, perhaps, to drop the tree between a Mercedes and a school bus full of children, with nothing but inches to spare on each side. With pulleys and ropes and lots of delicate chainsaw work, he would coax the tree to the ground, determined to see it land precisely in the spot where he wanted it. Once that was done, we'd strip the limbs and the branches and cut them down to stove-length pieces, and then we'd turn our attention to the trunk, working backward from the top of the tree to the bottom. As the cuts became progressively thicker, the chainsaw whined louder and higher. "Sharpen that blade, son. A dull one's twice as dangerous." I still remember how my arm shook, even after the saw had been turned off and stowed away. Hauling all that wood back to the house was a full day's work, but splitting the larger chunks into smaller pieces that would fit into our insatiable wood stove, that was a chore without end. Every day after school meant an hour up in the woodpile with Dad. I can still hear his voice as I got ready to swing the axe. "Aim for the chopping block, son, not the wood. If you aim for the wood, you'll hit nothing." A smart man named Einstein once said, "People love chopping wood. In this activity, one immediately sees results." Being Einstein, he was right. Chopping wood does yield immediate results. It's immensely gratifying just watching the progress unfold. But up there in the woodpile, the gratification was always delayed. Delayed because my father wasn't just teaching me how to swing that old double-sided axe. He was teaching me that work and play were two sides of the same coin. He was showing me that hard things, challenging things, could also be fun. In fact, the challenge was where the fun was. Today, I wonder, did the Morrisons have a woodpile behind their house? Someplace where George could show Jim that there were dangers involved when it came to cutting against the grain? A place to illustrate the consequences of driving wedges too deeply into the stubbornest stumps? What I know from personal experience is that fathers and sons can find the right words. They can find them in the woods when they go there together to get the fuel they need to keep their family warm. Chapter 13. Call It What You Will. Peter stood dumbstruck in the doorway of his bathroom, searching for just the right word. Ghastly came to mind, followed in no particular order by gruesome, grisly, and graphic. There, on the bathroom floor, sitting in a puddle of his own blood, was Peter's uncle, Sir Samuel Romilly. Moments earlier, the two men had been in the study, going over the treasure house Peter had been working on. Then Sir Samuel had risen from the couch, walked into the bathroom, picked up a straight razor, and dragged the blade across his throat. "Dear God," cried Peter as he ran to Sir Samuel's side, "what have you done?" The answer was self-evident. Samuel Romilly had severed his carotid artery, along with his windpipe. Heartbroken by the death of his beloved wife, which had occurred 3 days earlier, the poor man had entered a state of bottomless grief. Or was it something more than grief? Despair, perhaps? Devastation? Despondency? Call it what you will, the mental anguish had been more than Sir Samuel had been able to bear, and Peter could only watch as his uncle tried to scribble his final thoughts onto a piece of bloody stationery. "My dear," he wrote, "I wish..." He couldn't find the right words. He sat there, instead, staring at the blank page, bleeding all over the bathroom floor. Moments later, he died in his nephew's arms. Peter was no longer dumbstruck. He'd moved on to traumatized, nonplussed, astonished. Gobsmacked, he did what he always did when the chaos of an unpredictable world threatened to overwhelm him. He walked back to his study, opened his treasure house, and started writing. 2 years later, sitting alone in the gloom of his parlor, Peter was once again searching for just the right word. Was he depressed? Probably. With a schizophrenic grandmother, a paranoid mother, a bipolar sister, an overly anxious daughter, and of course, a suicidal uncle, Peter knew that melancholia ran in the family. But to what degree was he afflicted? Was he disheartened, or merely down in the dumps? Was he disenchanted, dismayed, or demoralized? Would he succumb to the same darkness that had claimed his uncle? Call it what you will, but as Peter pondered the precise nature of his malaise, his ennui, his languor and lugubriosity, he couldn't help but notice that the wheels on the carriages passing by his window appeared to be breaking the laws of physics. At least, that's how they looked through the slats of his partially opened shutters. Interesting. After much observation and careful thought, he concluded that his eyes were retaining an image of the spokes for a fraction of a second after the slats in the shutters had interrupted the rotation of the wheel, thereby creating the illusion that the spokes were moving backward. That wasn't just interesting. That was intriguing, titillating, maybe even beguiling? Call it what you will. Peter was definitely onto something. So once again, he reached for his treasure house, which was considerably thicker than it had been 2 years earlier. He began to write a detailed analysis of what he had just observed. He called it Explanation of an Optical Deception in the Appearance of the Spokes of a Wheel Seen Through Vertical Apertures. Not exactly the title of a bestseller, but then Peter wasn't writing one. He was just trying to make sense of the chaos in an unpredictable world. The result? Hundreds of scholarly papers on countless natural phenomena. In this case, a detailed explanation of the defect in the human retina that came to be known as persistence of vision, a principle that explains the illusion of motion, a principle that led Peter to fabricate a prototype with a shutter similar to the shutter that hung in Peter's parlor and an aperture similar to the window from which his shutter hung. Now, I suppose I could just say, that's the way I heard it, and direct your attention to Tinseltown, where the name of the man most responsible for creating the motion picture camera is honored today with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. I could, but I won't, because ironically, or perhaps paradoxically, or better yet, unjustly, Peter's name isn't there. Nor is it in the halls of NASA, even though Peter invented the slide rule, a mathematical breakthrough that enabled us to get a man on the moon. Nor is it on the aquifers of London, even though Peter did find a way to purify England's drinking water. Nor is it on the facades of hospitals, even though Peter was primarily responsible for the development of general anesthesia. Peter's name isn't on the cover of the Encyclopedia Britannica, though hundreds of scholarly papers he wrote on countless natural phenomena can be found therein. No fewer than 300,000 words written by Peter, words that helped explain the chaos of an unpredictable world. The point is, we don't remember this prodigy, this polymath, this pan-sophic for his incredible list of accomplishments. We remember him for his incredible list of words. Specifically, the list of words he compulsively compiled to combat the depression that perpetually plagued him. Words whose early assemblage began as a unique form of therapy, but whose ultimate congregation went on to become an eponymous compilation of rhetorical replacements that went on to sell no less than 40 million copies over the next two centuries. I refer, of course, to the indispensable directory of dialectical determination that was destined to dramatically increase the word count of every term paper that's ever been written, authored, or penned, while helping millions of aspiring writers prove conclusively that alliteration almost always annoys. I'm talking about an unparalleled linguistic lineup of syntactical substitutes, a crucial compendium of etymological options, a singular source of all things synonymous, conceived in serendipity and dedicated to the proposition that no crossword puzzle should ever go unfinished. Call it what you will. That tome on your bookshelf wouldn't be there today but for the grief-stricken uncle who died searching for the right words and the melancholy nephew who never stopped collecting them. A remarkable collection that Peter Roget called his treasure house, or, if you prefer Latin, his thesaurus. A while ago now, on a flight to Baltimore, the same flight I'm on now, in fact, I stumbled across an Atlantic article about Roget. It was not what you would call complimentary. The article was written by Simon Winchester, who's worked on various documentaries for the History and Discovery channels. I've had the pleasure of narrating a few. Winchester wrote a terrific book, too, about the making of the Oxford English Dictionary, The Professor and the Madman. I'd recommend it. In fact, I just did. But I was surprised to find that, putting it mildly, or gently, or reticently, Winchester was not a fan of Roget's thesaurus. In Winchester's view, Roget did more to discourage good writing than encourage it. According to The Atlantic, good writing has little to do with finding the right word and everything to do with the brave employment of the words that one already knows. Our literary powers are born, Winchester wrote, not out of banal and mediocre suggestion, not out of lexical shopping lists, but out of passion, thought, and intensity of feeling. Is Winchester right? Beats me. With or without Roche's help, I wouldn't know how to write novels. I wouldn't know where to begin. But I do write these stories, and from time to time, I must confess, my search for le mot juste compels me to consult the innumerable and countless, multitudinous and myriad, infinite, incalculable, and unnumbered possibilities that Roche's affords. In fact, I did when I wrote Roche's story, which begs the question, was the tale really diminished, lessened, minimized, or smallened in some way when I started to lean on that linguistic crutch? What about my captain up there in the cockpit? Is he cheating me out of an honest flight by relying on the autopilot? By the same token, did I cheat on my taxes this year by relying on the sucker and support of a little machine I call the calculator? Whatever the answers are, good on you, Simon, for protecting the integrity, the probity, and the sanctity of the writer's craft and profession. But let's hear it, too, for those who have pulled themselves up by their own intellectual bootstraps while conceding that sometimes it's okay just to ask for some help. Chapter 14, Not Your Typical Homemaker. Julia stepped out of her tent after dawn and marveled at the sight in front of her. A sloping hill covered with wildflowers, a pristine beach, an unlimited view. Bill was a catch, no doubt about it. Handsome, successful, ambitious. His proposal had taken her by surprise, but having slept on the idea, Julia was still undecided. Bill was the kind of guy who believed a man's home was his castle, which begged the question, did he see himself as a king? If so, what did that make her? Bill's happy little homemaker? Coincidentally, or maybe not, Julia held in her hands a copy of yesterday's San Francisco Examiner, which Bill had left on her suitcase. On the front page, just below the fold, was an article entitled Rules and Advice for Wives. It wasn't really an article. It was more like a public service announcement, printed for the edification of America's aspiring homemakers. Did he intend for her to see those rules before he popped the question? Julia didn't know, but she perused them, nevertheless. 1. Don't be extravagant. Nothing appeals more strongly to a man than the prospect of economic independence. 2. Keep your home clean. Nothing is more refreshing to the eyes of the tired, nerve-racked worker than the sight of a well-tidied home. 3. Do not permit your person to become unattractive. A slovenly wife makes a truant husband. Well, Julia thought, rule number 1 shouldn't pose much of a problem. Her tastes were sophisticated, but so too were Bill's. Surely the purchase of a few nice things wouldn't threaten his masculinity. Likewise, for rule 2, she was all for keeping a clean house. But did Bill really expect her to be dusting and vacuuming? Surely a man with his resources would spring for a maid. Regarding rule 3, Julia understood the importance of appearances. Hers would be maintained, regardless of their future together. Rule 4 read, do not receive attention from other men. Husbands are often jealous, and some are suspicious without cause. Do not supply the cause. Actually, thought Julia, that wasn't bad advice. Bill was possessive and made no secret of it. She knew all about the phone calls he'd made before popping the question. Pointed calls to specific men with whom she had a history. If she said yes, rule 4 might be worth heeding. Rule 5 was, do not resent reasonable discipline of children by their father. Mothers should not assume that all chastisement of a child by his father is severe and unjustifiable. Not an issue, thought Julia. Bill already had 5 kids, 6, if you believe the rumors. If he wanted to slap them around, that was none of her business. Rule number 6. Do not spend too much time with your mother. You may easily, in such a way, spend too little time at home. No worries there. If she said yes, Bill would become her priority, a simple fact she and her mother would have to accept. Rule 7. Do not accept advice from neighbors. Have a plan of your own for the solution of home problems. Neighbors, thought Julia. What neighbors? Julia doubted that there would be any neighbors at all. As for a plan of her own, that was a given. Julia never did anything without a plan. Rule 8. Do not disparage your husband. Funny, thought Julia. Bill is basically in the disparagement business. And what nasty thing could she possibly say that hadn't been said 1,000 times already? Rule 9. Smile. Be attentive in little things. An indifferent wife is often supplanted by an ardent mistress. Julia snorted. Bill had a mistress and everyone knew it, as well as a wife. But Julia understood attention to detail. Indeed, it was her obsession with the little things that had attracted Bill in the first place. Rule 10. Be tactful. Men, in the last analysis, are but overgrown children. They do not mind coaxing, but they resent coercion. Femininity attracts and compels them. Masculinity in the female repels. Julia snorted more loudly this time. She knew that certain men were impervious to feminine wiles, just as certain women were immune to the charms of men. It was a fact to which she could personally attest. Yet here she was, a single woman who'd been whisked away to this most romantic of locations to ponder a proposal from a married man with a mistress who'd promised to make all her dreams come true. Bill emerged from his tent, holding two cups of coffee. Julia folded the newspaper and tucked it under her arm. They stood together, in silence, sipping their coffee, admiring the wildflowers, the beach, the Pacific. "Location, location, location," said Bill. "It is a good one," Julia agreed. "Have you come to a decision?" "I have." She turned to face Bill, who owned the newspaper, tucked under her arm. She considered his reputation, his penchant for yellow journalism, for printing wild rumors and spurious gossip. She also considered his budget. "Are you sure you want me?" Julia asked. "I'm not your typical homemaker." Bill grinned. "I don't want a typical homemaker," he said. "I want to build a home with you." She took a deep breath and nodded. "Okay," she said. "Let's do it." And so they did, right there on a sloping hill covered with wildflowers. As always, Julia began with a plan. When construction ended, 3 decades later, Bill's family campground had been transformed into 123 acres of gardens, terraces, pools, and walkways, a zoo filled with exotic creatures, and in the center of it all, a new home with 165 separate rooms designed by the homemaker who'd had the good sense to accept Bill's proposal. No, no, not a marriage proposal, a business proposal. A proposal to build a home unlike any other, made to the first female architect licensed by the state of California. A woman who left behind 700 unique buildings and homes, all marked by her tireless attention to detail and unwavering commitment to satisfy her many clients. Say what you want about Bill. Back in 1919, when Americans believed a woman's place was in the home, he hired a homemaker to build one. A woman who shared her client's belief that a man's home was his castle. In this case, a castle by the sea, built by a trailblazing architect named Julia Morgan, and made famous